Welcome to Inscape Quest, where insightful conversations redefine perspectives. I'm your host, Trudy Howley. Join me as together we delve into discussions about relationships, work, and passions, unlocking profound insights that may shape our lives. This is Inscape Quest, where the journey within meets the quest for understanding. My special guest today is Ali Schultz. Ali is a founding partner of Reboot.io and an executive coach. She weaves business acumen with the innate wisdom of the body. The world's wisdom, traditions, and the way of the horse to help her clients reconnect to their truest self. Ali has a master's in religious studies from the University of Colorado, and as a certified Equus experience facilitator, she's an avid horsewoman and an artist as well. She lives with her partner and a small herd of beautiful horses at Deep Peace Farm in Colorado. Welcome, Ali. I'm really grateful for you being here today, where hopefully we can engage in some conversation about how workplace can be a place where we can really achieve our fullest self.
Thanks for having me. I think this will be a fun conversation.
So it seems important at this moment of time when we have awareness of increased polarization of groups, that we also have an increased awareness of power dynamics showing up in society at large. I'm hoping that finding new and healthy ways to understand about individual balance, that you could enlighten us as you specifically work with exploring how the way of the horse can serve as a model for leadership and how horse and humans can be successful together, and what horses may teach us about executive presence.
That's a lot to put on one animal. And I do believe that horses offer us the experience of a different way of being, and specifically a different way of being in relationship. I'll say it feels like to be in right relationship to a horse means that it's not a relationship of dominance or something oppressive in the sense that, you know, you're just with an animal and that animal is just an object and they're just their job. To be in right relationship with a horse, it requires a different way of being with yourself ultimately. And all of those skills that we can glean that space, that inner space, that individual space, we can then bring into the arena with our horses or with a horse and really experience relationship from that place in a real-time way in which we're getting feedback. So there's a lot that one can glean from the experience of being with horses that will travel really well into many other areas in life. And so in thinking about different areas in life and noticing what those dynamics might be. I mean, power dynamics can show up in the microcosm of our barn stable environments. They'll show up in, of course, bigger corporations, startups, historic systems like the legal system, school systems, etc. Any place there's a hierarchy, right? We think dominance, we think there's one leader, we think those types of things. You could even include family systems or parenting in some of that thinking. Well, I will say this. What we've learned in our family systems, whatever we've originated in, we've learned a lot about relationship or what it means to be in a relationship according to what we've survived as individuals, as individual humans. And we bring that information into any of the environments or arenas that we find ourselves in as we navigate life. And without looking at what we learned and how those beliefs were formed in our early imprinting, we can fail to see how our way of being in the world, if left unquestioned, or if we don't get curious about it, it may a way that's impacting the systems that we're in or the relationships that we're in a negative way.
As you're talking, I'm thinking about a conversation that I had with a previous podcast guest that we were talking about history of horses. I was thinking in particular about the novel Black Beauty. And as you're talking about ways of seeing and showing up in the world and remembering that book was the first ever novel written about horses and the way we can look at life through the eyes of others, through the eyes of the horse. So as we introduce the idea of understanding ourselves better through the eyes of horses, other sentient beings, why do you think that's particularly useful at this moment in time?
It's really hard for me to think about Black Beauty without getting choked up. That's like the one book. I can't even watch the movie. I can't even get through the movie trailer. And I think the beauty of that story in particular is we start to see this other being as something other than an object. This thing has feelings. It has some inner experience. And even without being, anthropomorphizing. No, is that the word? Yeah, anthropomorphizing of the other animal. There's a being there. There's a sentient being there. And horses, in reality, are so sensitive and they feel their way through their lives. Horses in a herd are safer than a solo horse. So when you think about it, a horse that flies solo is not a safe horse at all. And there's a lot that the herd provides. The herd provides safety, protection, comfort, resources, connection, clarity, all these things. And within the herd dynamics and the herd system itself, there's a lot to think about in how horses organize. They're much more of a lateral system than a hierarchical system. And that is contrary to what we think about when we think about this myth that the stallion is the leader of the herd and he has a harem of mares and, they make more horses. That's really not how it is. In the horse's world, with that lateral system, everyone in the herd has their own role to play. And everyone has their own level of confidence playing that role. So how they are in the group and learning where their place in the herd is depends on where their spot in the herd is. Sometimes we see this when we let our horses out with, a new group of friends. It either works or it doesn't, or it takes about a month or two for them to sort it out themselves. But in the wild, it's interesting to note that the leader of the herd is the one who moves the least. I'll repeat that. The leader of the herd is the one that moves the least. They're not the most charismatic. They're not the most hand-wavy. Not the most running around doing a lot of things. They have so much gravitas and attunement to what's happening in the larger field surrounding them and to the individuals in space that they can move less because they're noticed. If there's a group of young horses horsing around, so to speak, or causing a bit of a commotion, there may be a situation in which a leader really only has to twitch an ear for those horses to stop what they're doing, go back to some sort of, space, something more harmonious, another a feel or a vibe that's more harmonious. Same goes for, let's say there's a horse trying to get out a pile of hay or a certain resource, water, food, whatever. And, if the leader was commanding his space, he might have to just look at a direction or wrinkle his nose, and the horses might then just move away. Like, they notice everything about the leader in that way. But the leader has that sense of gravitas. And horses in general, with each other, whether they're the leader or not, they have a connection and a way of being with others that is, that's highly attuned. As I said earlier, like, they are bodies in space. And that's how they know their world. That's how they process their world.
In terms of understanding horses in this way, moving as a group, and that there are individuals designed to exist as a herd, they mirror human social behavior and relationships in this way. Why is it helpful to look at human behavior when we know that horses are prey animals and humans are predators? Is it because you're saying that the horses' nervous systems are highly attuned and that they can therefore register intentions that are around them by other beings?
Absolutely. As a course, if you are about to become lunch for someone, like a tiger or a lion or something hiding in the bushes, your instincts are pretty keen on knowing that this lion was just sitting by the watering hole with me, and a few of us were totally fine, and then this lion started pretending to be a rock. So something is going wrong. And suddenly the situation doesn't feel safe, right? So horses are incredibly attuned to incongruencies within their environment and within other beings, humans excluded. And it's a pretty well-honed instinct as a prey animal. And so when you put humans and horses together, what you get is, as a human, you have a 1,200-pound biofeedback mechanism in your space to tell you how safe you feel to them according to their instincts. And that level of sensitivity that the horse has, I will say two things. One, humans also have that. We often override. And two, that sensitivity is one of the key things that has made the horse one of the most successful land mammals on the planet. I'll add that as a human, it's this congruency is important because you want to be, you know, that phrase, be the dog that you're, or be the owner that your dog wants you to be. In the same way, like, how can you be the human that your horse needs you to be? How can you be the safe part that's the safe haven that your horse needs you to be, that your horse might want to follow, that your horse would trust? In order to achieve that, you know, in the horse-human relationship, you have to find that congruency in yourself. It requires owning how you're feeling right now, even though you may not want to name it. It means really inquiring, well, how am I right now? I haven't asked myself that, like, in the last 6 months or maybe the last few hours or maybe the last few decades. But in a way, it's how do we become more human? How do we become more vulnerable? How do we become more authentic with ourselves so that those in our presence are safe with us or feel safe with us? And so even as I'm talking about this now, I am intonating, and this translates into our human spaces too. In fact, it translates in a really big way. And so but if you have the opportunity to work with horses in a way that gives you feedback about how you're showing up in the field and how you're affecting those you're with, it's really great information to then take and work on with whoever you work with, you know, if you're inner work or a guide in that, in your interscape, you know, inquiries, because that's where that could be a big piece of growth for you as a human.
These seem to be really powerful statements in understanding both human and horse dynamics and the interrelational dynamics. And I love what you've said about horses don't override themselves, that they have this authentic presence. And ultimately, it's all about feeling safe in order to go back to whatever their nature of being a horse is. And what I'm hearing you say is that if you don't meet the horses with presence, then in a very similar way, that actually happens or can happen with the humans in our lives too. And so my understanding is that when you're present and curious about their world, the horse's world, or other humans that you're interacting with, if you don't have an agenda other than to be there with them in the moment, that's where the real power lies.
I agree 100%. We'll reach back for you. That presence is so different than the oppressive, dominant stance that, you know, that we talked about earlier. And when you have a more power with dynamic versus a power over dynamic, as my mentor Kelly Wendorf will say, that's available. That mutual curiosity is available, and this relationship is available. And it's a really potent and magical space. And it does require one to be very present and aware, really, in the here and now. It's, you know, the relationship then has a chance to have a little bit more harmony, right? Everybody's on equal footing. Not like somebody's holding something over someone else, right? The human isn't holding something over the horse. And it leans much more towards, as you were noting, the pleasure of being together. The curiosity then is, what's here for us, you know, in this moment? Where might your attention be? Where might my attention be? How can we come together? And how can we, you know, how can I as a human see what you're seeing over there, horse? And how can we play in that space of togetherness? There's a lot more true partnership that's possible in that space. And it takes more time to get there, right? So I guess they posit this as for the humans who have horses or who work with horses, you know, for a living, it's a whole different rhythm than I have to exercise 9 or 11 horses a day and get these horses training program, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is a different way of being horse. And Warwick Schiller often quotes a leadership book. I believe it might even be Brené. I'm not quite sure. But he'll say, you know, you put relationship before the task. And when that is in place, especially with the horse, you're saying, here I am in this relationship and I see you there and I feel you there. And what now do we want to do with our time together? Obviously, the horse is not going to respond in words, right? So as a human, we must be attuned in a different way into that. All those other ways of knowing the world that are like the 93% of nonverbal ways in which we communicate and understand bodies that we are around. You know, I think so many horses, just look at the horse industry, so many horses that are in training are really objects where they are the thing by which things need to get done every day. They're part of a program and there's a rhythm and a bunch of tasks that they need to complete. And the relationship is very often overlooked, besides obviously the occasional, you know, molasses muffin or carrot, etc. So there's a lot more that can happen even with the functional horse-human relationship or the transactional horse-human relationship. That's how I think of those training situations. Traditional training situations, probably. When there is a larger awareness and a wider awareness put on the relationship itself, and maybe less of an awareness around, you know, lunging in circles or drilling another pattern, whatever it might be. Similarly, I'd say in work environments, think about the humans you work with. If you can't attune to the person who's in front of you, as a manager, that's going to be a bit of a problem, right? Humans aren't software and humans aren't robots. Unfortunately, it would make management so much easier. And work is probably the most people-y place, and the people-y things are the hardest parts of most work environments. And so learning how to lead the person in front of you, if you are a leader, if you are a manager, is going to require a similar method of putting relationships before task. So you begin, you know, you enter that space with curiosity, with an open mind, with presence, and you build a relationship and then move it into, hey, what do we need to do today? Or what are our goals? How are we doing on things? So the intention to show up that way in our relationships, to show up with presence, it's something that we can bring into work environments, something we can bring into our homes. Hopefully we bring it into our homes. That's where we need it as well. And especially if we're parents, it matters in all of these situations because these are our relationships in life. And how we show up there creates this ripple effect in an interpersonal way, not just in our one-on-one spaces, you know, our communities as well. And so really knowing how am I showing up in this space helps us understand how we're affecting that space and that relationship.
Everything you're saying is so very profound. Generally, we really are living in a very fast-paced world right now. And I get the sense from talking to other people that in all those messages, that there really is just this sense of we're just not enough. So I love this idea that you're talking about of thinking more along the lines of relationship before tasks. And, you know, this idea of play and mutual curiosity and potency and where the magic happens. I like this idea of maybe we can be more adaptive and more flexible through understanding how horses behave in their natural environment and how they interact with us. And also especially appreciate all the work that you're doing at Reboot. And I do want to let listeners know that you have lots of wonderful free resources on your website. And I'll put your website in the show notes. But I think all this that's coming into the general public's awareness really is a gift. And you had previously mentioned about the nervous system. I'm understanding and seeing that there really is a lot of information now in the public domain about how the nervous system works. And it's becoming more and more common to have that language of the nervous system. Fight, flight, and freeze responses are a little more common in regular use these days. I'm wondering if you might just dive into the idea of the parasympathetic reset that's just very, it's essential to the very nature of being a horse and being a successful horse in terms of an alive horse. Jane Carroll, who I'd interviewed in a previous episode, she describes the parasympathetic reset as a horse going back to grazing.
I think my favorite quote or way to frame this is in the herd with horses, if something happens, there's unrest, there's a disturbance, there's something scary that just ran through the pasture, or something threatening, or something perceived as a threat, they will rearrange themselves, run around, chase the thing out of the way. And once the threat is gone, they back to grazing, like Jane said. Linda Kolanoff says it this way. She said, horses return to a state of deep peace, which is, I guess, one of the namesakes that I named my own farm after, one that and a Celtic poem. But that is the parasympathetic reset. And for humans, I think we went around a lot with a lot of threats that even if they go away in reality, they don't always go away in our mind. And I think that's the gift of the prefrontal cortex maybe that we have, or the way that our brains are arranged and all the different parts of our brains that have evolved through time, like then talk to each other. Like it's harder for us to not perceive the threat as real. If we have a worried thought, if we have anxiety about something, it just like our mind gets on a track and it's much harder to get off that track and come back to a space of deep peace or to just go back to grazing. And so parasympathetic reset, especially for humans, adapts us long term, whether it slides us into burnout, depression, health problems, whatever it is, like that's the path there. But our ability as humans to realize when our minds are on that track and it's going really fast, and how do we then get off of it? How do we come back to what hopefully is a true reality for us, which is, oh, I can take a deep breath. Oh, I am alive. I can take 3 deep breaths. I can walk around and just be in my body. I can stare at the sky and feel safe. I can do what I need to do to regain a sense of inner safety. These are all things that can help us reset internally. A sigh often helps. Yawning, I think, is somewhere in the mix of things that can help us. Box breathing, like there's all these different tools we can reach for to facilitate the reset on a nervous system level. But I think it's such a fun metaphor to lift from, we could call it horse culture, right? And all right, the threat's gone. We don't have to run anymore. It's back to grazing. Like we are copacetic. The harmonious resonance has been restored.
Yes. You know, Peter Levine talks about that a lot in his work about the nervous system and just this idea of, yeah, we are alive. So noticing what's going on in the body, coming back into the body and, you know, bringing ourselves back into, away from a state of dissociation or unfreezing the numbness that we're here. We are alive. And everything you're saying is so important. And how do we be with all this stress? It's interesting. And in the concept of a book that Mark Rashid wrote, it was a wonderful book called Horses Don't Lie. He said that we're looking at their nervous systems, horses' nervous systems, because they're so big. So it's actually easier to see what's going on. They're these giant nervous systems in front of us, and we can learn their body language, where it may be a little harder for us to start learning what the nonverbals in another human being might be like. So in this very large way, we get to see what nonverbal communication really is, what the language of the body is. And for horses, their bodies, as you've described, are literally their lifelines.
Yeah. Because they don't have the words. And so everything in their world means something. And Lucy said earlier, they process with their whole bodies. They think with their whole bodies. And as humans, we're so cut off. We're above the net, primarily, right? We're thinking. We're rationalizing our world. We forget we have a heart. We forget we have a gut. We forget we have intuition. We forget we have all these other ways of knowing in the world, and ways of resourcing ourselves, and ways of making decisions, and ways of being informed as a human mammal, right? And it's, you know, for horses, they live that all the time. That's their lifeline. And for us as humans, one of the questions that, again, like I work with my mentor Kelly Wendorf, was how do you get access to your horse body? How do you assume that horse body? How do you start to find that in yourself? It's a really interesting metaphor to play with. You know, how can we be more embodied in our lives and through our lives to whatever degree that it feels safe for us? And how can we begin to parse the information that we're getting by living that way, by showing up that way in various situations, so that it informs us with from a wider perspective, right? We're not just operating from our thinking brain only. You know, for a horse, every little bit means something in the herd. And we as humans, it's really similar. And I think once you gain an awareness of the subtleties and the shifts in physiology, for example, but even the subtleties of feeling states, you can begin to see how you shift for example, in a group situation versus, you know, individually or with a certain person over maybe someone you love dearly and who loves you back just for who you are. We can begin to understand, how do I show up in groups? How do I show up in differently in relationships? What's mine and what's not mine? Because I think as human bodies in relationship with similar to horse bodies in relationship, and we're mirroring off each other a lot, but we don't always realize it as humans. But even having a sense that concept exists, right? And that is what's happening. It can help us begin to parse out our human group environments, like work environments, other social systems, whatever organizational systems might be at play, or even other kind of relationship dynamics in our lives, in our bipedal lives.
So you mentioned organizational systems, and you've talked a lot about the somatic experience and awareness. How do you really apply that somatic experience in the workplace, in that organizational development work? How is it useful, everything that you've just laid out there?
Yeah, there's so much, I think, and goes back to how our nervous systems are as an individual and how our nervous systems are in groups. So in a similar sense to the horse, if I, as an individual, perhaps anxious or angry or afraid, let's just say afraid something, and I'm running that circuitry in myself, in my own experience, I enter maybe a meeting or a group situation at work, but I don't say, or I don't have a space to check in, a safe space to check in and say, wow, I'm really terrified about that earthquake that happened last week, or the situation with, you know, a colleague, whatever it might be. The people in that meeting with me are going to feel through a similar emotional Wi-Fi that horses have. They're going to feel that feeling. And if it's unnamed, they're either going to start feeling it and wonder what's going on, or they're going to like look at me and go, I don't know what's going on. I can't trust what she's saying versus what I'm feeling from how she's showing. And so in that way, there's so many layers of what's going on. How can I become more congruent with how I'm feeling? And how can I name that safely in a group setting? How can we in this group setting name safely for each other? How are we checking in? Are we maybe red, yellow, or green to pull in some polyvagal language or polyvagal vagal scale language? Do I feel safe? Do I feel triggered? Am I offline? How's my nervous system now? As humans, we need the words to help us narrate what's going on. Whereas with horses, they're leagues ahead of us in terms of they just get it by being there. With humans, we need to carve out, refine, and attune our depths of being, really, so that we can be with each other in a more intelligent and kind and clear way, I would say. But that really, when you think about it, is the crux of a safe environment, a safe place to be, especially in a working environment. I think another thing that's really interesting is tracking when we're present and when we're not present in a work environment. So if we're not present, what is it that knocks us back into our inner defenses or our argument building in our minds or trying to force an issue and black or white thinking? What is it that keeps us showing, being present? And how can we catch ourselves when we're not present and then loop back to presence? How can we show up in a place of curiosity so that we can get more done together, so that we can communicate in a way that is going to be better, hopefully, received in the group in a way that's not attacking or defensive or any of those fear-based tactics, not tactics really, but fear-based ways in which we're going to come off with a sense of that oppression entering the room again. I'm not saying we need work environments that are non-hierarchical. I actually think at work, hierarchy is essential and it's helpful for structure, as long as it's clear structure and job descriptions are clear and reporting structures are clear, it all works well. And hierarchy does not mean anything oppressive by any sense. if the humans in the room are building cultures through accepted, not even say accepted, but just through behavioral norms that say, hey, this is how we behave here. And so even from that place, the culture that you're building, which is the sum of all of the behaviors that are happening in the group, if you don't look at your cultures that you're building in your organizations early on and aim to create them with intention, you're going to set yourself up for a small disaster down the line. And setting up your cultures with an intention to be mindful of what you're putting into place means being mindful of a lot of things. How do we communicate? How do we check in with each other? How do we fire people? How do we hire people? How do we lean into hard conversations? How do we face conflict together in a circle? How do we challenge each other in a healthy way? How do we manage, or how do we communicate with each other what being in the red might look like? If our nervous system is checking in red, how do we then know how to support each other? I mean, there's so many ways in which we overlook like the basic building blocks of what it means to be in an organization, what that culture feels like. And that culture is the sum of all the behaviors in the organization. It's, do we have hard conversations? Do we not talk about things? What do we not talk about? But how do we talk about the hard things? Do we talk about everything? And all of that needs to be on the table in terms of how do we consciously start to look at all these little pieces so that it supports a more safe feeling space relationship, so that we can then create awesome things, do awesome things in the world, and, you know, meet these audacious goals we may have set for ourselves. So we're doing these tasks and getting some cool shit done.
As you describe both meeting work colleagues, where each person is at, and beginning to engage in more openness and more observations of others and self to get more clarity about really how we can do things in a more connected way. Also aware that both in coaching and psychotherapy, there's a real need for learning how to set boundaries at the same time as all this other building block stuff is going on. And I'm wondering what we learn from horses about setting boundaries, because you did say in a earlier part of our conversation that for horses, it's really not safe for them to trust incongruence. And so as we learn to set boundaries in our human herds, what might be the parallels there?
Yeah, and my favorite quote on boundaries is from Mark Molin. And it goes something like, boundaries aren't about keeping other people out. It's about keeping yourself in. And I feel like one of the keystone pieces of boundary work is not how do I control other people, but it's how do I do the work inside of me so that I can show up in this space as me with my boundaries intact. I know what I want. I know what I need. I know what I need to ask for. I know what I'm available for. I know what I'm not available for. And I'm willing to lead if I don't feel like what's here is going to work for me. And that's okay. But to arrive at that piece of ground as a human in our human herds is a really powerful place. And it demands a lot of inner work inside of us, a lot of self-trust, a lot of confidence, a lot of trusting our inner knowing, not abandoning ourselves, knowing what we need and want, and really feeling our sovereignty and like that first fidelity of I am for me first. And I know what I need. I know what I want. And I know when the situations that I'm going to be in aren't a match for me, or I don't want to be here, or they're not supporting me in the ways that I need. I mean, you can roll that out as a human into all your herds and be like, this is friendship. Make me feel small and want to run away? Or can I be me here? Can I be me at work? Can I be me in my most intimate relationship partners? And, you know, I will just also say, if you're, you know, horses have no problem taking risks. They have no problem saying, no, stop that. That's not cool with me. But humans, we have problems saying that. We have problems being direct because we feel like we're going to get kicked out of the tribe, or we're going to end up in whatever pathways lead us to our individual steaming pile of shame that lives on inside of us and keeps us small. Somehow our sense of belonging is really close to shame, and whatever our shame is, and being able to assert oneself or be with oneself or hold one's space as a human in the way in which horses navigate through their herd life it can be a really stark comparison with really bold differences. And it's a really awesome thing to see when people can begin to assume more of their own agency when it comes to boundaries. And they can get more and more comfortable with that.
I love this concept that you're talking about of in terms of keeping your sovereignty intact. I love it. There's so much weight to what you said. It seems like once you've done your internal work processing and the awareness and actually not creating more harm in the world, that keeping your sovereignty intact is so key. So thank you for talking about that. I'd actually really like to share a quote from Mark Rashid, who I'd mentioned earlier as the author of Horses Don't Lie, because it ties in with what you were just saying. And one of the many wonderful quotes he has is, he says that horses are nothing if not a study in harmony. It's not so much that they strive to stay in harmony, but rather they are skilled at re-establishing it once it's been lost. It's the way things work in nature. And without occasional discord, there can be no harmony in the first place. It's that ebb and flow that brings life, like the beating of a heart. And one of the reasons for this is there's a lot of horsemanship these days that isn't geared towards working with the ebb and flow. So anyone expecting absolute perfection from a situation that involves the interaction of two different species, such as horses and humans, they're going to be in for a fairly substantial disappointment there. And applying everything you've said to horses and humans together, really, harmony isn't about perfection. It's about synchronization, coming together for a common goal, not a mechanical type of synchronization that's, you know, evolves through repetition of endless circles or ritual habit patterns, but through a synchronization that's flow, blended energy. And, you know, that's what brings the spirit to life.
Yeah, I love that so much, actually. And I think that's what happens in our relational spaces as well as humans. When you're present, when you can be attuned, that's the real magic. And it requires, you know, not directing your life from your mind only and, you know, not being out of control, but it's thinking that you must control all the things or that you do control all the things. You know, you have to be in a place of allowing. You're also showing up in a way that's shallow and just purely transactional. I do this, you do this. I do this, I'm going to make you do this. If you don't want to do this, that's hard, a hard relationship. And I think those gritty and granular spaces of being together, whether it's with you through this podcast process, Judy, with our intimate partners in life, with people that challenge us in life, our cats, you know, our favorite four-legged friends, those more interpersonal spaces really where the magic is. That's where the connection happens. That's where our hearts fill up in a much bigger way. And perfection is in, honestly, just the feeling of that and the fact that we seek it. You know, perfection is certainly not filling some glossy image of what we paint relationship must look like. You know, it's how present can we be? And what's here for us now in this space and this relationship? And it's a real jewel, or it can be, if you're with the right person, or perhaps the right animal, right? To be able to be in a place where you have your experience and it loops. They have their experience and it's a shared thing, but there's a check-in and there's play and resonance or a place of connection and a place of acceptance. I would also say safety and belonging are there as well. But it's a space in which I would posit, you know, part of the magic is this feeling where love can actually exist, true love, in a way where there's just this mutual aspect of I am here in my fullness and I see you there in your fullness and I don't need you to complete me. And yet somehow you are adding to my experience in an exponential positive way.
Absolutely love what you've said. And I think as you're talking about allowing for space, for flow and for magic to happen and noting that there's energy there and there's also space for balance as well. And it's really a beautiful aspiration to wrap up our conversation with today. And I'm really grateful for everything you've shared with all your insights, wisdoms, and experience. And we have a lot more to talk about, I know. And I think hopefully there's a lot of things here that listeners will get out of what you've shared today. So thank you so much, Ali, for being here.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the InScape Quest podcast. Please don't forget to share this episode with a friend and hit that follow button. We're excited to reconnect with you on our next adventure. Be sure to find us on Instagram at InScape Quest for more content. Until next time, keep exploring the inner realms.